Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming this evening. I suppose you had a very limited choice, but I do appreciate your presence. Listening to the birds, and earlier today, listening to the rain was really a delight. And I thought I would share with you, I almost did it during Zazen, but I thought it was too much of a too long a piece to share during Zazen. But I thought I would share with you one of my favorite poems, which many of you will have heard me share before, because it is one of my favorite poems. But to me, there is also, it's a wonderful vignette of Dharma, or of teaching. And it is appropriately called Wet Evening in April. And since we have a wet evening, and it's April, I thought, it fits the bill. The birds sang in the wet trees. And as I listened to them, it was 100 years from now, and I was dead. And someone else was listening to them. But I was glad I had recorded for him the melancholy. Okay. The last line I sometimes change. I was glad I had recorded for him or her the joy, or whatever we want to put in. But the actual poem says melancholy. And maybe there is something melancholic about the birds singing in the wet trees. For me, the Dharma part is the I was dead and there was someone else listening to them. It's the experience is reborn. The experience of listening to the birds singing. What has changed is the self, it's not the experience. So thank you for all the questions that you've posted on the notice board. I will try to weave them into the Dharma talk and answer the questions as I go along. And then there's some that will be left over, and I will try to address them in tomorrow morning's class. Bev, could you make the clock visible to me? Thank you. So when we're sitting in Zazen. Zazen means sitting Zen. So it's when we're sitting Zazen. When we're sitting Zen, I ask people to make an effort to be present. For me, Zen is the art of being present. And the space that we set up is an expression of that art. So too, the robes that we wear. It's like we create this space where being present is just that little bit easier. So being present, I mean, you can do it anywhere. You can be waiting in line in the supermarket, you can be present. Or you can be making an effort to be present. You can be filling up your shopping cart and making an effort to be present. When you're walking down the street, if you can just be walking down the street, but usually we're doing something else. And because we're doing something else in our head, there's a degree of separation from what we're doing and where we're at. But we can make the effort to be at what we're doing. A significant part of Zen practice occurs in the kitchen. And we say, when you're chopping vegetables, just chop vegetables. Easier said than done. But the place where it is a little bit easier to be present is in the zendo, or the meditation hall. So I say, returning again and again. The reason I say again and again is because when you return to being present, you get distracted and start wandering off again. So you return again. And each time it happens, you return again. It is a little bit like herding cats. And you may think it's impossible to herd cats, but it isn't. I found this out 20-something years ago. They do get the message. A group of cats, if you repeat it often enough and provide, very much like dogs, the stimulus, but cats take a little bit longer, they will act on the stimulus. Right? Cats can be trained, believe it or not. And because they can be trained, they can be herded. At least it looks that way. So, returning again and again to the present. And the reason we want to be present is because all life takes place in the present. Okay, we spend a lot of time going into the past and going into the future mentally, going into a kind of virtual space. But the life that is happening in the present. So we are avoiding our life when we're going into the past and when we're going into the future. Our life is in the present. So returning again and again. But you know, I'm looking at a blank wall. It isn't much fun. So our mind starts conjuring up stories. It starts to create stories that would be interesting. Whether they are just fantasies, sci-fi nature, kind of space travel, or more concrete fantasies about something else that I could be doing. And these have a tendency to separate us from the present, from where we are. So Zazen is the simplest, most direct form of being present. No stimulation, just being present with what is. And gradually, in that stillness, we find a vitality, but more. I think I said somewhere on the first day, by being present, one indication is when there is a sound, or if somebody were to call your name, would you have the experience of being brought back to your senses. In other words, were you drifting off into some story? If somebody were to ring the bell, as indeed they will, would you have the experience, or do you have the experience, of being brought back? So being present is to be already here when that stimulus happens. If we come back to the present often enough, like herding cats, we get the message. And we say, okay, I'll do it. That duality that I was talking about earlier today, where one part of me wants to do this, and then the other part of me immediately sets up a resistance. So that resistance is gradually overcome, and then you find you stay present for longer periods of time. You also find that the length of time it takes between distraction and returning is reduced. That's because your intention is gaining strength and your resistance is weakening. So we remain present for longer periods of time, and in so doing, we become more present. What do I mean by more present? Well, you may find that after a retreat, or even after a one day of sitting, you feel more present than you did before you started. Or contrasting that one day of sitting with the day before, saying, yeah, yesterday I was really scattered, but today I'm much more centered, I'm much more present. So this brings up the idea of degrees of being present. And I would say, keep going down that path of being present. And eventually, you become present. You become that present. There is no you being present. There is only present. It is you, and you are it. You have merged with the present. So, initially when we start this path of making an effort to be present, we may have the idea that there is the past, and there is the future, and there is this very thin slice of time that's in between. And that very thin slice of time is what we call the present. But how big is that slice? As we make the effort to be present, that keeps getting smaller. It's a little bit like differential calculus. We want the experience right at the zero point. Now, if you hear something, by the time you recognize that you've heard it, it's already in the past. That's getting into a very short interval. So you hear somebody cough, or you hear a dog barking, or you hear an engine start. By the time you recognize that what you've heard is an engine starting, the engine starting is already in the past. So can we make the effort to be even more present and just be there as the situation arises and the next one, so that we're not involved with naming the first one and missing the second one? In other words, can we be totally present? At that point, you are the present. Now, before all this happens, we have going on inside us what I call a karmic momentum. And that is based on past activities. We have set up karmic wheels or karmic momenta. And so when we want to escape the present because it's a lack of stimulation, these karmic wheels start turning and we start thinking of other things that we could be doing. So this interruption of the karmic wheel, our intention to be present, keeps interrupting that, keeps interrupting the stories, the scenario that we are presenting to ourselves. And gradually over time, this interruption slows down the momentum and eventually brings it to a halt. So when we are completely present, this is being Buddha. And the movement towards this is taking refuge in Buddha. Now, taking refuge. We chant, "I take refuge in," depending on what part of the world you're in, "I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha." Or the Americans, "I take refuge in Buddha. I take refuge in Dharma. I take refuge in Sangha." This sitting, this moving towards being present, to me, is taking refuge in Buddha, in being or becoming Buddha. Taking refuge in the Dharma is taking refuge in the vast body of teachings that help us become present. So we may be experiencing some anxiety in our life, a stressful situation. We may be experiencing grief or anger or strong desires. And if we read or study the Dharma, through repetition, we are reminded that these things are impermanent, or the famous saying, "This too will pass." And because it will pass, I don't have to get caught up in it, or I can distance myself a little bit from it. I don't have to be driven by it because it will pass. It's impermanent. It is insubstantial. It has no existence of its own. I do not need to get caught up in it. And it is insufficient. Whatever satisfaction it will bring me is only temporary. So I take refuge in the Buddha. We are often taking refuge in something. But we don't usually see these somethings as a refuge. We take refuge in alcohol, coffee, food, nightclubs, a whole load of things. But the point is that these are not, they don't get to the root of it. So when we are experiencing grief, or something is annoying us, or we just come home and say, gosh, that was a hard day, I could do with a drink. We're taking refuge in the beverage. The first three of the 16 bodhisattva precepts is a reminder to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And to me, this comes about quite naturally. You begin to see that the Dharma, or the Buddha, or the Sangha, is a much more it's a much deeper refuge than all the other things. Taking refuge in the Sangha is perhaps coming into the meditation hall and sitting with others. You know, it's easier to be present when you're being present with others. So we support each other in that practice of being present. This is taking refuge in the Sangha. It can also be that you feel so overwhelmed by what is happening in your life and that you go to sit, you just cannot do it. But when you go to sit with other people who are not experiencing such overwhelming circumstances and they are well established in their being present, it really is a support. It really helps you to be present. And this being present, it's sitting through whatever comes up. The first thing that comes up, you may notice, is physical pain. Pain from sitting. You may be okay for one period of zazen, but when it gets to number 7, your body is beginning to ache. So somewhere along the line, we notice aches or pains. Now, there's a judgment call for you to make here. And one of those judgment calls is this pain doing damage to my body? Now, obviously, if you're experiencing pain, it's doing some damage. But what I mean is it doing a lasting damage? In other words, like if you have a pain in your knee, is it torquing a ligament? Is this going to be an injury? And if it is, if you think it is, if you've decided that it is, then you should move. But a lot of the aches are just from the aches of being in the same position. And they'll go away, they'll work themselves out pretty quickly. It can be really beneficial to sit with these aches. The best ones, of course, are the ones that are completely not related to your zazen posture, like a headache. Because then it's either sit with it or go to bed or do something. But if you're sitting, then you sit with it. And it's not a question of your zazen posture that's causing the ache. But quite often it can be just simply as a result of sitting in the same posture hour after hour and day after day. And learning to sit still with that discomfort can be a great training. So we talk about Zen training. This is it. I prefer the word practice, but it just happens that training fits in quite well. It's a little bit like, yeah, this is what Zen training is, sitting still. Because what we're learning to do is to be comfortable with our discomfort. And that extends then to other areas of discomfort. So you're having a conversation with somebody and you notice that you're getting uncomfortable, but you can remain present and grounded with that discomfort. So the discomfort doesn't manifest as anger or annoyance towards the person, because we can manage our own discomfort. So as we learn to sit still and let our legs and our back have their own zazen, we allow these, we make room for this discomfort and allow it to be there. Then we may notice that our mind is becoming more still. The discomfort acts as a kind of, it's going to draw you into the present because you are making room for it to be there. The only way for you to allow it to be there is to be present. Normally we try to separate ourselves from it, then we start to move, and once we start to move in a fidgety sense, it's going to be extremely difficult not to continue with it. So as we get used to allowing the discomfort to be there, and I continue with my effort to be present, that discomfort draws us more fully into the present. The same is with grief. The same is with anger. The same is with bliss. What else do we have? Same is with desire. If we can allow these emotions or feelings to be there and not mentally act on them or act them out, but continue to be present, they will fill our whole being and then they will leave like a tidal wave. It will come in and it will go out. And when it's going out, wow, you'll be free. So being present, taking refuge, discomfort, learning to sit with our discomfort, physical and mental. Now, somebody asked me if I could say a little bit more about koans. And I thought, great, because koans make for wonderful bedtime stories. And if there's ever an occasion where you find yourself on my website for whatever reason, there is a link to a YouTube playlist called 10 for Zen. Just 10 minutes for some random Zen musings or Zen thoughts. And I recently put one up on the two moons of Yunyan. So it's fresh in my mind. I'll share it with you now. Maybe I should say a little bit first, though, between Soto and Rinzai. Rinzai Zen is famous for its koan practice. Soto is not. In Rinzai Zen, you will be given a koan by the teacher or your teacher. And then the setup in the Rinzai Zendo is designed to put you under pressure to come up with an answer. Okay? So it's a little bit like, I don't know, it seems a little bit like forced Kensho, right? We'll force it out of you. And to me, there's a thin line between the encouragement of pressure from the teacher and from the setup, from the way the Sangha is set up. There's a thin line between encouragement and abuse. One person could easily experience that encouragement as abuse. So you are given a koan, and then you're put under pressure to come up with an answer, and if it's too much for you, you'll leave. Right? In Soto, it's much more the question of, well, life will bring to you its own koans. And this is what happened to Siddhartha. Right? He, the first three sites, and then the fourth sight. Don't forget the fourth sight. The first three sights framed the problem, the rotten terms and conditions that we're living under, right? But the fourth sight suggested a remedy. And so when he went out on his spiritual quest, this could be seen as his koan. How do we resolve this thing of dukkha, the dissatisfaction? It's often usually translated as suffering, and it does include suffering, but its real meaning is dissatisfaction. So we could say that dukkha was his koan. And on a particular night, in his search for a resolution of the problem of dukkha, he came up with an answer that solved it for him. So we have various koans. In Soto, we say that life brings you its own koans. So it could be dukkha. It could be death. It could be meaning. It could be So there's often this thing, translators, I was thinking about this today. I was thinking, first of all, I started out thinking it's the translators that did it. So to me, the correct formulation of the koan is, what is the sound of one hand? But in English literature, it's almost always presented as, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And I think the clapping is an addition. So the story goes, when two hands come together, a sound is made. What is the sound of one hand? Okay. But for some reason, I was thinking, no matter how good the translator is, it seems to end up as one hand clapping. And then I have the insight, small eye. It might not be the translators, it might be the editors who want to make something more saleable. And this happened with Norman Fisher's book, The World Could Be Otherwise. Now that suggests that we can embark on some kind of political campaign and change the world. The world could be otherwise if only we would get off our cushion and make it so. Right? But that isn't the title that he wanted. The title that he wanted was The World Is Otherwise. Now the difference is that when I see a book called The World Could Be Otherwise, I've little or no interest in it. But if the book had been called The World Is Otherwise, I would find that intriguing. What is he trying to get at, right? So, there's this kind of hard edge of koan practice in Rinzai, where the whole sangha is set up to put you in a pressure cooker to pop out an answer. Right? But in Soto, it's more like if you're dealing with koans, well, first of all, it's a koan that you found, or it found you, or you found it. It kind of is a phrase in the literature or something that happens in your life and you feel as though you really want to resolve this. And so it becomes your koan. And you sit with it, and there's nobody putting you under pressure to come up with an answer. Any pressure that you feel is coming from within. It's coming from yourself. It's your own sense of wanting to resolve this. And as you sit with it, it can really help you to be present. You keep coming back to it. You keep coming back to it. And it helps you to be present because it takes paramount, the resolution of it takes paramount importance. And all these other distractions cannot outweigh the importance that the koan has for you. So it can help us to be present, and it can become a thread that connects all our other activities. As we're getting on the bus, as we're walking down the street, it'll be working its way. It's a little bit like an earworm. It just works its way in, or a virus. And it's going to bring the whole intellectual system to a standstill. Right? So the koan as a virus. So this koan that I'm about to share with you, I'm calling it the two moons of Yunyan, but it could just as easily be called the two moons of Guishan. Okay. It may grab you or it may not, but it's certainly entertaining and it's a good bedtime story. And although I've gone over the time, I might be tempted to elaborate a little bit, but we'll see. So the story goes, these are two ancient Chinese Zen masters, Guishan and Yunyan. Now I don't know if they were Zen masters at the time of this exchange, or if they just happened to be practicing in the same monastery as like Rebecca and Anshin. Right? So you can imagine Rebecca and Anshin. So were they actually Zen masters at the time of this incident, or were they students, Zen students? So, Yunyan is sweeping. Don't know if anybody was given a sweeping job for this morning or this afternoon, but if you're in a Zen temple, you usually end up sweeping at some stage, right? Whether it's the kitchen, or the Ngawa is the wooden platform that goes around the Zendo, or the grounds, or the Zendo itself, or somewhere, you end up sweeping. It's a daily occurrence. In San Francisco Zen Center, there's about 5 or 6 people sent to sweep the sidewalk, the footpath, in front of the building. And there they are in their robes with ordinary people walking by, trying not to get in their way, whatever. So I'm sure it's sometimes the talk of the neighborhood, the Zennies out sweeping in their black robes. So Yunyan was sweeping, and Guishan was walking by. And Guishan said, "Too busy." Okay. So this leads to a question of, what does it mean to be too busy? I'll leave that with you. Guishan says, "Too busy," as though you're not supposed to be too busy, right? So there's a little bit of a reprimand in it when you say too busy. And Yunyan says, "You should know." Okay, so is he saying, "You should know because you've been around this temple long enough," or "You should know because you're a Zen master," right? He says, "You should know there is one who is not busy." There is one who is not busy. So, at Zen Center, there's a teacher named Daryu, Michael Wenger, who yearly led a retreat at Tassajara called, I forget what the first one, it's Finding the One Who Is Not Busy, or Searching for the One Who Is Not Busy. So this becomes a koan that you can put into practice. When you're doing something, can you find the one who is not busy? In this activity, can you find the one who is not busy? And I would go even, it's just as good, can you find the one who is busy, right? So, okay, I'm warming up. I might do the elaboration thing, but I've never done the elaboration. So, Guishan says, "Too busy." And Yunyan says, "You should know there is one who is not busy." And Guishan says, "Well, in that case, there are 2 moons." Now, in Zen, the moon, particularly the full moon, represents reality. Okay, so Guishan is saying, in that case, there are 2 realities. There's the reality that I see, and there's the reality that you're telling me about. I see one who's too busy, and you're telling me there is one who is not busy. So in that case, there are 2 moons. Yunyan holds up the broom and says, "Which moon is this?" Okay, that's the koan. So when you're going about your work meditation, this is a meditation practice, you can integrate it with your work. Can you find the one who is not busy? Can you find the one who is busy? Should I tell you the elaborate? I kind of feel as though I backed myself into a corner. I haven't told anybody this. It's been recorded, is it? Maybe I'll save it till tomorrow when it's not being recorded. How about that? Yeah. Let's do that. Okay. And somebody can hold me to it. Right. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are numberless. Delusions are inexhaustible.